there, center. Pitch to Flowers. Gives it off to Bidette, the wide receiver. DeeDee Lamb and Mayfield. What a play. Touchdown, Oklahoma. And Mayfield is waving the arm in the air like he just don't care. Bromwell handed to Chubb off a right guard. Stays on his feet. Speaking of big plays, here's another one. Chubb to the 20. Tag 5. Touchdown. Nick Chubb, a 50-yard touchdown, making something out of nothing. And here we go again. Fromm gets it, hands off to Sony Michel. What a hole down the right side. 10-5 touchdown. Sony Michel rips off another big one, this time for 38 yards. And we are an extra point away from a tie game. Fromm throwing for the end zone. It is caught for the touchdown. Javon Wimb. And just like that, Georgia on top. Mayfield now will throw it across his body back in the end zone. Caught, touchdown. It's Dimitri Flowers, the fullback. And we're an extra point away from another tie game. Hands off to Michelle. Football comes out. It's loose. It's picked up by Oklahoma. Stephen Parker picks it up and runs it back for the touchdown for the Sooners. Takes the snap, runs to the right, now cuts to the left, into the end zone for the touchdown. They cut out the middleman, Jake Fromm, and Nick Chubb runs it in. And with 55 seconds remaining, we're an extra point away from a tie game to give Oklahoma the lead here in the second overtime. And it's blocked. The field goal is blocked, and we stay tied at 48. And Georgia, the opportunity to kick a field goal and win. Michel will take the direct snap and run to his left. Try to turn the corner. He does. The 20, the 10, the 5, touchdown. And that's how this one will end. And Georgia pours onto the field. The third-ranked Bulldogs will play for the national championship.
But our kids are so resilient. They never stopped chopping wood. They kept fighting. They believed. There was offensive players affecting defensive players in the locker room at halftime, and they kept fighting. Best news is we get a chance to play again.
I quite frankly just missed throws. Didn't make the throws I normally make, and then that showed. Can't believe it's over.
Picks the snap, little slant ball tipped in the air, and it's picked off. Back downfield at the 5. Diving towards the pylon. Touchdown, Matt Wilson. And Alabama pulling away, 23-6.
I think this game was about our identity as a team. I don't think that anybody could question the relentless competitive attitude that we played with. We played the kind of game we wanted to play on offense, scored when we had the opportunities to score. You know, this is something that I'm really, really pleased and happy for our players. They really worked hard.
I don't think there's a lot to say. I remember standing approximately here last year and apologizing to our fans. Poor job we has done as owners, and I would just reiterate that again. Our record's unacceptable, and we accept full responsibility for that. This Hugh Jackson will be back as our coach next year in 2018. He and John are already off to a good start and working well together. You could say a lot of things about us this year. Down to the last minute or 2 minutes, our guys played hard. And I think the primary job an NFL coach has to do is provide leadership, and I think he's provided great leadership.
This morning, I spoke to Coach Caldwell, informed him of the decision not to retain him as the head coach of the Lions. I feel like there was a need in change in the leadership of this team, and starting today, I'll be leading that search to hire a new head coach for the Lions. Coach Caldwell is a good football coach, a good man, good husband, father, grandfather. On behalf of the entire organization, I want to thank him personally and for his service over the last 4 years. Jim has great work ethic. There's not a day that's gone by that his car wasn't in the parking lot before mine. He puts a lot of time and energy into this team, where we are today, part of what Jim did, and I'm proud to say that I worked with him. At the end of the day, it's want to take this team to the next level, and to me that's, you know, winning championships. That's winning playoff games, and that's winning the Super Bowl. Ultimately, I'm the person in charge of the football operation here at the Lions, and ultimately, the record that we've had the last 2 years is on me. Really, the standards that I have and the Ford family has for this team are greater than that, and my goal is to go out and find the best head coach to bring us that championship.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Welcome indeed to the very first extravaganza of the calendar year 2018. Thank you so much for joining us. It's 11 minutes after 3 as we get the ball rolling on this Tuesday. Feels like a Monday to pretty much all of us, but it is indeed a Tuesday, and we really appreciate you being a part of our conversation today. We're going to open up the phone lines early and often in and around the guests that we have scheduled for you, 866-240-1065. To be quite honest with you, there are too many massive stories to discuss today for me to kind of get them all in on my own. I will just get onto one or two of them and riff far too long because we only have 2 hours. It's one of those days where I wish I had a six-hour show. I could fill all six of them because I have so many different massive topics that deserve a lot of discussion and conversation. But we've got two, so I want you to help me guide them. Maybe you can kind of pick the story that you want to talk about most from the list that I will provide you momentarily, and then dial 866-240-1065 right here on the ticket. Hope you had a great New Year's Eve and New Year's Day celebration. Back to work today, and they were doing some work last night in college football, so that's part of what we're going to talk about. As you just heard, the Rose Bowl, one of the greatest Rose Bowls ever, except for the fact that they played it the way they played it. I'll explain that in a second. But then, of course, we have some massive news from the National Football League as well. Somehow, some way, in some strange world, a guy with a winning record named Jim Caldwell was fired by the Detroit Lions, while a guy with a 1-31 record was retained by the Cleveland Browns. Talking about Hugh Jackson. This is like upside down world, topsy turvy. How do you make sense of that? It's just not sensible. And I'm not saying, by the way, that Caldwell shouldn't have been fired. I think there's a case for it. I think there's a case you just heard Bob Quinn talking about at the end for not winning playoff games. I understand that. You know, this team doesn't want to just win and go 9-7 a few times and 11-5 once in a blue moon. I understand that. But I'm just saying that if that guy can get fired for going 36-28 in his tenure, how does a guy who is 1-31 get to keep his job? It is simply staggering, and that's what Jimmy Haslam was trying to explain there in the clip prior to Mr. Quinn in that montage. But there are so many different things. Let me run it down for you as we get rolling this afternoon. So many different things I want to talk about with you. Number one, college football. They had their semifinals last night, and it will be an all-SEC final with Georgia and Alabama going at it. Georgia outlasting Oklahoma in a game that was legendary, outstanding, exciting, filled with big plays, filled with high drama, and then they ended it on God-blasted penalty kicks. I cannot abide by that. That is something that cannot be allowed to stand in football. I almost said in professional football. This is college football, but just in football. I don't care if it's high school. I don't care if it's college. I don't care if it's the National Football League. You have got to stop ending great football games with penalty kicks or in a shootout the way they do it in hockey or in soccer. You cannot reduce a game that is played 100 yards at a time at all times until we get to overtime. And now 75 of those yards don't matter. We're playing 25 yards and in. Kickoffs don't matter. Kickoff returns don't matter. Punt and punt return, field position fights don't matter when trying to decide the outcome of a great game, a championship caliber game, a championship implications game, because the winner goes on to the national championship game. The college football joke of an overtime system reared its ugly head at the worst possible time, ending what was an outstanding game for 60 minutes of regular football play into just a few minutes of ridiculousness, and I cannot underscore that enough. Georgia outlasting Oklahoma and Baker Mayfield. Baker Mayfield had the game taken away from him, not by Georgia, but by Lincoln Riley, his very, very young and inexperienced 34-year-old head coach, who wet the bed when it came to play calling and not allowing his playmakers to make the plays they had made all game long, late in the fourth quarter and in overtime. Absolutely abysmal play calling, not letting Mayfield throw the ball down the field, not letting Anderson, who ran for 200 yards, get the ball on fourth and one or on third and two to try to go up the gut, trying to run everybody outside, trying to run swing passes to the outside, turning what had been a very vertical game all game long for Oklahoma into a suddenly very horizontal/lateral game when the game is on the line because he has no guts because Riley had no hint of how to handle a pressure situation like this. He didn't trust his Heisman Trophy winner. He decided, I'm going to play it safe and throw it short and wide, and I'm going to run wide reverses and pathetically little far too close to one another pitch options or option pitches with the game on the line. Absolutely horrific play calling, absolutely horrific coaching, and then just to throw this part in, yes, I'm a little bitter. I wanted to see Oklahoma win, just FYI, in case that wasn't apparent in my conversation. I wanted to see Oklahoma win the football game. I think they would have been a much more entertaining matchup with Alabama, who I picked to win the second game, and they did. I thought Baker Mayfield in that ridiculous Oklahoma offense against Nick Saban's Alabama rock-solid defense would have made for such a great final, and I wanted to see that happen. And it should have happened. But Lincoln Riley, the coach coach of Oklahoma, simply was just out of his element. Out of his element when it came to play calling late. Out of his element when it came to just allowing your brash, cocky Sooners to be brash and cocky Sooners. I mean, they make that touchdown to put up their 31st point at the end of the first half on a double reverse throw back to Baker Mayfield on a run-pass option, which was spectacular. What an unbelievable play call at just the right time. They sold it perfectly. It was tremendous. They should have gone into halftime with the head of steam, full of momentum, all of those different cliches that you hear talk about where they're flying high and feeling great about themselves, and Georgia's in the locker room going, holy crap, how are we going to stop these guys? They put up 31 on us in a half. That's what should have been the case. Instead, because Lincoln Riley getting a lead and deciding, I better play it safe, I better play it carefully, I better play it close to the vest, I better be cautious. Instead of letting his cocky Sooners be cocky Sooners, he says, well, we don't want to kick one deep and have it returned for a touchdown. I'll squib it. And he has his kicker squib one right to the up man. Right to the up man in what turns out to be a failed onside kick. And gives the ball to Georgia, first down with, 9 seconds left on the Oklahoma 47. A 10-yard out later, and they've got themselves a 55-yard field goal opportunity, which Georgia predictably nails, with some dude they picked up in the parking lot wearing horn-rimmed glasses with tape in the middle and calling him their kicker. I don't know who he is. He looks like he's some science major who just came to the game, and they said, hey, will you come and kick for us? Okay. So he came and kicked for him and drilled one from 55. And suddenly the Oklahoma lead and the Oklahoma momentum down the tubes. They still had the lead, but the momentum gone. Absolutely gone. Georgia sprints down the tunnel into the locker room right after them going, yeah, we just took their best shot. Look how we finished it. Oklahoma goes in there going, what just happened? Why did we kick the ball to the up guy? The first line, the front line and kick. Are you kidding me? And by the way, I heard this stat earlier today, and you might enjoy it. What did Oklahoma have to fear from kicking the ball deep to Georgia and then going down in cover at the end of the first half? Not a whole hell of a lot. Do you know how many kickoff returns that the Oklahoma Sooners have given up for a touchdown in the last 6 years? That would be a big fat goose egg. Zero. But now we're going to squib one? Because we don't want to give up a kick return for a touchdown at the end of the first half, and then we give them 3 points. Lincoln Riley and the Oklahoma Sooners took the game out of Baker Mayfield's hands, took it out of Anderson's hands, decided to get cutesy and trying to protect the lead. They put up 31 in the first half, 0 in the third quarter. And you say, oh, Georgia's defense adjusted. Yeah, they did to an extent, but what did they adjust to? They adjusted to an Oklahoma team that changed the way it attacked the entire second half. They changed it into we talk about this all the time when teams go into prevent defense mode, right? You got a lead, go into prevent defense. Oklahoma and Lincoln Riley went into prevent offense. We just need to control the clock a little bit. Let's run the ball a little bit. We don't need to take shots down the field. Let's keep it close to us. Let's not turn it over. And all that crap that completely allowed Georgia to get back into the game. And Georgia took full advantage. No disrespect to the Dogs. The Bulldogs won. They'll go into the championship game. We'll talk about that in a bit. But Oklahoma gave that game away every step of the way. So I want to get into that. Was it the greatest Rose Bowl battle ever? Anybody who says that, you know what? You need to go back and watch Vince Young and against Matt Leinart and Reggie Bush and the boys back in 2006 again. Watch that one again. I still think that one was better. And besides, I can never get over the double overtime. Way they did the double, and they call it double overtime as if they had played another period and the grueling battle continued. No, it's the stupid trading possessions double overtime garbage that I never want to see in college football again. It was putrid, it was pathetic, and a terrible way to end the game. The other side of the All-SEC final, of course, Bama, who did exactly what you knew they were going to do. They were going to prove all of the Buckeye fans wrong. They were going to prove all of the doubters and the haters wrong who figured they just get this position or this spot, this fourth spot in the playoffs, based on their status, based on their name, based on being Bama, based on Nick Saban. They didn't earn it. They didn't deserve it. Alabama's not the fourth best team in the country. All they did was beat the living snot out of the number one team in the country. Clemson couldn't breathe. I mean, Alabama's defense smothered them. Choked the life out of them like they were serial killers, for crying out loud. Couldn't breathe. 24-6, gave up less than 200 yards of total offense to a Clemson team that had just been rolling over everybody. Alabama proved that the committee knew what they were doing when they gave them that spot. Anybody who thinks that the Buckeyes would have been able to do that to Clemson with that kind of defense just is watching life go by through scarlet and gray covered glasses. Let's be honest, Buckeye fans, this was the right thing. Bama belonged. They proved it. It's time for us to admit it. So that's on the table for us today. Also, as long as we're on the Big Ten, somebody's going to have to explain to me how it is that Jim Harbaugh, a man who I said I wanted to be the home run that Michigan needed to make, needed to have, needed to hit when it came time to hire the coach to replace Brady, the coach to replace Brady Hoke, it's got to be a home run. It's got to be Jim Harbaugh. I said two things. It's got to be Jim Harbaugh or Les Miles. It was Jim Harbaugh. And here we are right now, and I have to ask this question. How is Jim Harbaugh making more money than Nick Saban right now today? How is Jim Harbaugh earning more money than Urban Meyer right now today? How is Jim Harbaugh head coach of the 8-5 Michigan Wolverines? A Wolverines team that is 2-7 against the big three that they face in the Big Ten, Ohio State, Michigan State, and Penn State. A Michigan Wolverines team that finished this season 8-5, blowing a 19-3 second half lead against South Carolina. Not the beasts of college football. How does Jim Harbaugh justify his salary right now? And how does anybody explain that, you know, or try to defend that Jim Harbaugh's team is on the right path, on the right track? They're pushing up toward contender status for national championships or for playoff berths. They haven't tasted a conference championship game under Harbaugh, and now they look like they're going in reverse. They look like they're going backwards. Untimely turnovers, fumbles, drop punts, interceptions. All kinds of mistakes that you should not have being made by a disciplined team. I thought Jim Harbaugh was a disciplinarian. I thought Jim Harbaugh demanded better of players than the ridiculous mistakes that his guys made in blowing a 19-3 lead, which, by the way, blew the Big Ten's perfect would have been 8-0 bowl season. Instead, the one loss belongs to Harbaugh. And yes, he is taking fire from all sides today. He was taking it yesterday. He was really as soon as the game ended, and justifiably so. Michigan fans want more. Michigan fans expect more. I'll be honest with you. Michigan fans deserve more. But Jim Harbaugh does not deserve more money than Nick Saban after what Saban just proved again against Clemson, nor more than Urban Meyer, whose Buckeyes took apart on Friday, took apart the Pac-12 champion USC Trojans. Simply embarrassing for Jim Harbaugh. So we've got those stories. And as I mentioned, the NFL, somehow Jim Caldwell is fired and Hugh Jackson is not. Speaking of the NFL, John Gruden to the Raiders, for real? He's coming back and he's going back to be Chucky in the land of the Pirates, soon to be the land of Las Vegas? Yes, and he's going to get an ownership stake, according to reports, to take that job back after he had it, of course, up until 2002 when he was traded to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and of course ended up beating the Raiders in the Super Bowl in 2003. And then of course the other big story of the day, Isaiah Thomas making his long-awaited debut for the Cavaliers. He will play tonight, but he will not play tomorrow when the Cavaliers face the Boston Celtics, his former team. Why? Because it's a back-to-back. And why? Because why put him under that kind of a microscope and that pressure against Kyrie Irving in just his second game back from injury? So all of that is on the table. 866-240-1065. 866-240-1065. Want you to weigh in on any or all of those subjects. You pick the direction we go, because like I said, I could talk about any one of those stories for 2 hours, if you'll let me. Jimmy in Toledo, let's let him pick what he wants to talk about. Hey, Jimmy, go ahead.
What's up, Bob? Listen, man.
Happy New Year, brother.
I'm going to first say Central Florida kind of proved everybody wrong, and they probably should have got the eight-team playoff thing going pretty soon here, because I remember talking with you. They would be had a legitimate chance, and I think they proved that because they've got a victory over Auburn now, and Auburn beat both the teams that are in the final.
That's true.
And I think they did it. I think they did it legitimately.
I still don't know
shocked.
That I would have given them one of the top eight spots, Jimmy. In my world, if it's a top
four,
it was a top eight, I go the five Power Five conference champions and three at-larges, and the three at-larges are going to go to the likes of Alabama and who knows, maybe Penn State or whatever. I mean, you just got to look all around. It's probably not going to go to a team that is still playing in that conference at that level against those opponents. A schedule like that isn't going to lend itself to being one of the three at-large teams. It would if it was 16. It probably wouldn't if it was eight.
Well, this whole power at-large bid thing, if you have eight, they should, if you just use the eye test, I think you can make an argument
for
them.
Yeah, but your eye test is going now after they beat Auburn. The eye test after beating the teams that they played on their schedule, it's a little bit of a different vision, you know what I mean, with that eye test.
Well, I mean, I don't know how many times we have to go over this, but they put people in the pros, too, and you know, the athletes in Florida, they're being recruited all over the place, so I don't. That's not really why I called. I really called because I wanted to make fun of Michigan fans out there. And I heretofore, I was a big fan of the Harbaugh hire, and I thought he was getting the defense together and the special teams. All that had improved, and you could definitely see the improvement in the depth of Michigan.
Yep.
But there's just something troubling. I'm a big Ohio State fan. You know that.
Yes, I
didn't think they belonged in the playoff this year. I think they would have fared well against Clemson. At least I don't think Clemson would have done much against their defense. That's for certain. I think we'd have probably handled their offense as well as Alabama did. I can't say much for our offense still. But anyways, to digress back to my point, I think they've basically got a $7 million version of Brady Hoke up there, and I think it's funny. I've really soured on Harbaugh. I'm looking at it like this. He's a great coach, I think. But what he did out at Stanford is he brought big boy football to the Pac-12 or Pac-10, however you want to look at it.
He punched USC in the mouth. That's what he
did
out there that really helped.
Exactly. But he did it with a caliber of athlete that is a Stanford guy, highly let's face it, you go to Stanford, you got to be highly disciplined because you're there on academics for the most part. They can't just recruit five-star guys there. You got to get in there. You got to have a lot of brains. I'm not saying that you don't to go to Michigan.
I was
going to
say, I think the same thing, you could say the same thing about Michigan. And Jimmy, I got to run, buddy. Thanks for the call. I'm going to get some other people on the line. But I'll tell you this about Harbaugh. I'm with you. I have soured on him as well. Now, does that mean I want him run? No. But I will tell you this. This pivotal season coming up is the one. This is it. This is his deciding factor right now. In year four, his freshman class that he first recruited, these will be juniors, assuming most of them redshirted. They will be juniors. His second class, these will be sophomores. These are guys that should be contributing in a big way. And next season, this coming season in 2018, Jim Harbaugh needs to beat Ohio State and he has to beat Michigan State. I'll give him potentially a loss to Penn State or one of the three, as long as it's not Ohio State. And one loss going into the Big Ten championship game, he needs to win it and make the playoffs. If Michigan doesn't win the Big Ten championship game this coming season and make the playoffs, I will call the Harbaugh tenure a disaster at that point in time. I just will. There have been some things that were circumstances beyond his control, I think, in large part, that cost him already. But you know what? Games like this loss to South Carolina do not help you. They do not help your reputation as a big game coach. They don't help your reputation as the game's highest paid coach. And I think Michigan is going to be in some serious, serious trouble if they don't have this season being Harbaugh's pivotal season as a Big Ten champion. Joe in Grand Rapids is next. Hey, Joe, you're on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to touch on two things with you quick. Sure. Happy New Year, by the way, to both
you
guys.
Back at you, buddy.
You too.
And about the Harbaugh thing, I'm a Buckeye through and through, and I wanted to see them succeed. I wanted to see them be competitive like they were.
Right.
But it's all hype. It's all hype. It's all let's go to Rome. It's all let's sleep at the kicker's house to recruit the kicker. And they got a basketball player on their jersey. I mean, that's irrelevant as to their football play. But when you're an Ohio State fan and you look at them playing football and they got a basketball player on the front of it, you can't help but laugh.
I'll never understand that Jumpman logo. I don't get it. They're not the only ones, but they're the most high profile ones. I don't understand how the Jumpman basketball logo made its way into the football uniforms. I'll never
exactly.
What was the second point?
Now, the other thing was, I agree with you about 80% on the overtime, the NFL versus the college. I would like to see them maybe make some sort of a blend of the two. I don't like the 25-yard line. I don't like you're saying,
right.
You know, you're taking a lot of the football out of football when you do that. The only thing that I wouldn't want to see as far as the NFL rules, me personally, is I would hate to see that game last night come down to a kickoff return for a touchdown on the opening kickoff of overtime and have that decided.
Don't misunderstand, Joe, don't misunderstand. I am not in favor of the NFL overtime rule either. I don't like it either. My optimal idea is just play football. Put 5 minutes on the clock and play. And it's and you play all 5 minutes. If I score on the opening kickoff, it's your ball. And if you score coming back, it's my ball. Play until we come to a winner at the end of five more minutes. The most exciting time in any football game that's a close game, obviously, is the last 2 minutes. We wonder, is 56 seconds with one timeout left enough for the quarterback to get down there and get into field goal range to win this, or is it not? You replay that. You have it again for another five. And I'm not saying play a whole other quarter, but play five, but play the game with kickoffs, punts, field position, the whole damn thing, the way you played it for 60 minutes. You don't change it into a field goal contest or to a sudden death just because you go into overtime.
I could get on board with that, or what I was thinking was kick off to one team, and if they do happen to go down the field and score in the NFL, it would be over. In college, kick off to the other team. At least give them their shot. Don't start them at the 25.
And that's okay, but it still has that sudden death kind of quality to it that I don't like.
Yeah.
I don't want it to be just if you don't score on this possession, it's over. Because guess what? There's still time. Football is a timed game. It's not about, you know, untimed downs and like they're doing now with the 25-yard lines. And it shouldn't be, well, you scored and now you get an opportunity until your downs run out. To me, it's a clock game. You play five more minutes of real football, offense, defense, and special teams, and let the thing be decided by the players. Joe, I got to run, my man. Thanks for the call again. Real quick from Terry in Sylvania, because we got to get moving to get to our first guest. Terry, go ahead, sir.
Hey, first of all, the four teams they lost, the South Carolina, I could not swallow that defeat. The four they lost to were all top 15 teams,
okay.
You know. Wisconsin, of course, Ohio State, of course, Penn State, and with Michigan State.
Right.
Okay, I couldn't swallow this game. The offense has been the problem. Turnovers have been the problem. You're running a pro offense with a weak offensive line. They might as well go spread and open the field. But what quarterback are they going to get to do this? They've had quarterback issues after Jake Rudock left the first year.
I think that will be the key to their resurgence because they have some stud quarterbacks in this system. And I'm talking about not just Patterson, the transfer in, and not just Milton, the true freshman who's coming in, but the true freshman today who redshirted this year, Christian McCaffrey, who could run spread and do any and all of those things. But my question before you go, Terry, is this, because you know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but when you say the teams they lost to were all top 15 teams, it sounds like you're making an excuse. They lost to good teams. My point is, don't you hire a Jim Harbaugh and pay him more money than anybody else in college football coaching history to beat top 15 teams, not
okay.
to lose to them.
Okay, here's two things I'm going to tell you. Jim Tressel made this rivalry turned it totally around when he walked in the door at Ohio State. He was totally focused on Michigan.
Agreed.
Number two, Harbaugh has no excuse now. He's got to put up or shut up. He's going to have a tough road to hoe. He's got Notre Dame on the opening day, too.
Yes, you know, he does.
You know, they got a schedule and a half. If he gives me 10 and beats either Ohio State or Michigan State, I'd keep him one more year.
Well, I don't think they're going to fire him if he doesn't do those things. I think, you know, thanks for the call, my friend. I appreciate it. I don't think they're going to fire him, but I just mean as far as the hope that he is going to be the hope, the great, you know, blue and Mason Blue hope, if you will, to revive the once mighty Michigan program, to me, is going to fade if they don't do those things this year. All right, we're running late here. Kush, let's get wild.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents The Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day in the most exciting college football playoff game of the four-year run of the new system. The Rose Bowl win by Georgia over Oklahoma set some new Rose Bowl records. First off, first time in the 104-game history of the Rose Bowl that the game went into overtime. The other marks the one, and the other one is the 102 total points last night, made it the highest scoring Rose Bowl game of all time, beating last year's game that featured 101 total points. That's your Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day. Let's get a timeout for a bottom of the hour Sports Center. Bill Conley, college football expert, joins us next right here on The Ticket.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed, rolling onward we are at 3:44. Thanks for being with us right here on the Extravaganza. We got to get right back into college football and do it quickly because we were so excited by some of the great calls that we've had. We blew past our break a little bit and are getting to Bill Conley a little bit late. Bill Conley, college football writer and what we like to call the man we like to call the commissioner of college football, thanks to a great piece he wrote about a year ago. Bill Conley from SB Nation joining us. Hey, Bill, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Hey, good. Do me a favor. Help me take Jim Cushlin to task for a second, if you could. Cushlin, pay attention here and listen to Bill and I. You said in the Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day that, quote, in easily the most exciting college football playoff game of the four-year run of the new system, the Rose Bowl win by Georgia, blah, blah, blah. You really believe, Cushlin, that's the most exciting game of the college football four-year run?
I'm with you on the argument you were using last segment about the overtime thing.
Not what I'm talking about at all. I'm just talking about the game itself. Bill Conley.
I thought it was. I really thought it was. It was crazy back and forth.
That's because I think you're just not thinking. You're not thinking at all. Bill Conley, was this the most exciting college football game in the playoffs in the 4 years of the playoff system?
You know, this is a being kind of a picking, you know, which child you love the best thing if you're comparing that to like the last couple Alabama Clemson games the previous years and whatnot.
Specifically last year's. That's one I was talking about. It was
yeah.
a championship game down 31-28. Deshaun Watson hits Hunter Renfrow with 1 second on the clock with the game-winning touchdown pass to dethrone Alabama. How is anything better than last year's championship game?
If we're talking about start to finish excitement, then I think Georgia Oklahoma has a very good case for that because, you had many, many, many plot twists over the course of 60 minutes. Alabama Clemson last year, the fourth quarter was amazing. First three quarters were merely good, but Oklahoma Georgia was probably more consistently good throughout. So that's the case.
I'm going to go to the end, I guess, and that's where games are decided. It was
right.
24-14, by the way, for those who don't remember last year. Bama was up over Clemson in the title game 24-14 going into the fourth quarter. Four touchdowns later, three of them by Clemson, including, again, 1 second on the clock. The special player that Deshaun Watson was making that play to Hunter Renfrow to win the game 35-31 was just, I don't know. I mean, it was the greatest ending to a championship game that I've ever seen, I think. And
the ending was tremendous. But yeah. If you're just in it for four straight hours of, oh, my goodness, what's going on? Yeah, Oklahoma-Georgia was phenomenal. But, again, I just like not having to choose. I like that we have more to choose from, at least. And that's a very good thing for college football.
No doubt about that. Bill Conley, the commissioner, let me ask you this. Did Georgia win this game by taking it away from Oklahoma, or did Oklahoma choke this game away by being conservative and soft and not playing the way they played in the first half and putting up 31 by way of their play calling and their decision-making in the second half, particularly late in the fourth quarter and in those overtimes?
Well, here's the thing, and I wrote about this a little bit this morning at SB Nation. That was OU's thing all year. They put games away. Texas Tech turned the ball over on downs with about 11 minutes left, didn't get the ball back. OU just went 4 yards at a time all the way down the field. The fact that they had that card to play throughout the entire season is what made this one of the best offenses we've seen in a very, very long time. So really, for me, it wasn't that OU tried to do that. OU did that all year, and it worked. It was that Georgia was able to mostly Roquan Smith, but Georgia as a whole, they were able to sniff out plays. They're able to force OU to get a little more creative or gimmicky, I guess, with Kyler Murray and end rounds and all this stuff, because they didn't trust that they could just run straight at Georgia and move the chains. They forced OU to overthink a little bit, but that was Georgia. I don't think that was Oklahoma. I think that was Georgia making OU fail, basically, down the stretch.
But do you think that was right? Do you think, because I don't know why. I honestly think Lincoln Riley was just completely outcoached in this manner, because they were unable, Georgia was, to stop Anderson up the middle for most. They had 200 yards rushing, for crying out loud. When they have a third and two and they need a first down, they're running laterally, horizontally, yeah, trying to get these ridiculous little option pitches and everything else, because every time they ran him up the middle, they got yards. Whether it was 4 or 12, they got yards, and they got away from that being too cutesy, because I think Riley just didn't. I think he completely was out of his element in a big game situation there, and at age 34, maybe that's understandable.
Well, I mean, at the same time, he also completely and totally outcoached Kirby Smart in the first half, which was why the game went to overtime to begin with. So, I mean, the whole game counts in that regard. But I would say the two calls that I absolutely hated. One of them, the end around of Smallwood that Roquan Smith sniffed out, yep, in overtime. That was overthinking, because at the very least, you up the middle twice, you probably get 2 yards. Now, I would have also probably gone for it. You're in overtime with a team that you can't stop from running the ball all that well. You probably want to think about going for it when it's 4th and 6 inches or something like that. So I understand that coaches don't usually make that call. But the end around there, instead of just trying to go up the middle, was overthinking. The worst call in the game was the squib kick at the end of the first half, though.
That's what I meant
I hate squib kicks as a rule, but when everybody calls it, I can't really fault one coach for calling it. It is a thing in college football that needs to go, or in football in general, that needs to go away. You're scared of a guy returning the kick for a touchdown when even the really good ones do that, like once at, I don't know, 150 returns or something like that. It is overthinking, but again, everybody does it. Kirby Smart might have done it in the exact same situation there. So I hated that call, and it backfired. It gifted Georgia a field goal. And by the way, that clock operator also helped to gift Georgia a field goal with 1 second left. But no, those are the two calls that I really hated. Otherwise, I think it was just OU trying to be OU and Georgia doing a better job of it.
I'm going to call out OU anyway on the squib kick. You say everybody does it, and that's true to an extent. But here's the thing, and I heard this stat this morning, and it really made me even angrier, because I wanted to see Oklahoma win. I wanted to see Baker Mayfield in that offense against Alabama's defense.
Yep.
I predicted Alabama would win. But here's the thing. Oklahoma has not given up a kickoff return for a touchdown in 6 years.
Yeah.
Go cover the kick, for crying out loud. Yep. Quit trying to baby it by squibbing it, and then you kick it right into the up guy's hands and give him a first down on the fourth.
No, the squib in general needs to go away. I'm not a fan of the squib. It can go away.
Yeah, no question about it. So quickly before we go to Alabama and Clemson, what really frustrated me about the end of this game, and this is something I think you and I have talked about before, so I don't want to belabor it too much, but I just hate it so much that they ended this classic 60-minute tie game with penalty kicks. You know, it's a 100-yard field that's 53 yards wide, and we take away 75 yards of them to play overtime. We're going 25 and in, and you take out kickoffs, take out kick returns, take out, you know, potential squibs, mistakes, field position, punts. It's all just 25 and in, touchdown or field goal. It's such a terrible way to end a 60-minute battle.
Oh, man, give me that over.
Ending it by playing football.
You know, we can craft a pretty decent sudden death overtime situation, but give me college over pro when it comes to the way the overtimes are currently set up. Pro's worse. Pro somehow managed to figure out a way that's worse. And,
they both stick. I just want to play football. You know, Bill, I want to play football. Put 5 minutes on the clock and say, game continues. Coin flip. Let's go. If you score,
right,
we're playing for 5 more minutes. Somebody's going to win that football game.
No, I'm okay with changes. I know it could be a whole heck of a lot worse, because we see it worse in other leagues.
did Alabama prove the committee knows what it's doing? By giving them that fourth spot. A lot of people didn't like it. All they did was go out there and suffocate the number one team in the country, the team that had been playing the most consistently impressive football for the last 2 months. They suffocated Clemson, did not let them breathe, just like you kind of knew Nick Saban was going to do.
Right. I mean, yeah, it was a tough situation for Clemson just because, you know, the Alabama team that barely got in got healthier. And so this was back to kind of the original Alabama to a certain degree. Sean Dion Hamilton still out. And of course, then a couple guys got hurt late in the game. We'll see how that plays out. Alabama was a tremendous team. My S&P Plus rankings that I've been posting at Football Outsiders for the last 10 years, Alabama's number one. They were slightly behind Ohio State, which is funny in its own right, heading into bowl season. And then they went out and they dominated what I think was the number six or seven Clemson team. So I think they just lived up to being Alabama. But it does kind of – one of the interesting things about playoff selection in general, but, you know, basketball, football, whatever, is the whole best versus most deserving vibe, so to speak. We always – you know, the committee will say they're picking the best team, but they're not. They're picking the most deserving team, and then once they get to the playoff, the best team emerges. So far, that the best team has never been the actual number one seed in this tournament for four years now. And so Alabama, it was a debate whether they deserved to get in. But once they got in, they were the best team, and they probably will be on Monday, too.
Were you surprised at the ease with which they handled Clemson?
The turnovers made it look easier than it actually was. Clemson was driving to take the lead in the third quarter when the turnover bug bit. Now, granted, Clemson was driving to take the lead because of turnovers too, the one to start the second half. But generally speaking, I mean, the fact that Alabama was able to shut down a much more one-dimensional Clemson team, wasn't the most surprising thing in the world, no. The fact that they did it like under 3 yards per play, that's pretty crazy. And it allowed Alabama to once again kind of get by with what is a much more limited offense than they've had in previous years. The performance overall, take the turnovers away, and I think the margin's about what I expected it to be. I also spent most of last week talking myself into Clemson, too, so I can't talk there.
Bill Connelly joining us from SB Nation. Bill, a lot of the haters, and we're talking about the Saban haters, the Alabama haters, the college football playoff haters, the Baker Mayfield haters, and so on, are all over the fact that UCF beat Auburn. And Auburn, as you know, beat Georgia. And Auburn also beat Alabama. So, therefore, UCF is clearly the best team in the country. And when Danny White looked into the camera and said, we are the national champions, it's legitimate. How do you feel about those folks?
Well, first of all, I mean, claim national titles. That's how you know you're part of college football. So claim whatever you can. But, I hated the way that the committee treated UCF this year. I thought that, well, every year in general, the whole ain't played nobody thing, when you can still prove something against the teams you do play, I think it's an absolute joke that the committee doesn't have much G5 representation on the board or whatever, on its roster, I guess. The fact that they continue to make the same mistakes. G5 teams are 3-1, and the number 12 UCF team that played yesterday was the highest ranked G5 team we've had at the end of these rankings so far, and it's an absolute joke. UCF was easily a top 10 team this year. Now, that said, they probably weren't a top four team. If the committee wanted to make a point and put UCF at number four instead of Alabama, I would not have complained because UCF didn't lose, and the way they played yesterday, they very well could have beaten Clemson as well. But I was okay with them not being number four. They absolutely had to be higher than number 12. When they started off number 18 or whatever, it was an absolute joke.
Bill, let me interrupt. Does any of that matter if they're top 10? Say, okay, they're 9 or they're 8. If they're not top, because people are saying they are undefeated and nobody else is undefeated, and again, they beat the who beat, and you play that domino effect game, and that they should have been in the top four. That's the argument people are making. Do you buy that?
I don't. Top four is a reach to me, but here's the thing. I want the committee to be accurate, because if a Boise State comes around, or if a UCF comes back next year and goes undefeated again, I want to know that the four best teams, or the most deserving, or whatever we're talking about, actually have a chance to play for the national title. And so even if UCF wasn't top four, they were probably top six, maybe top seven, and they should have been in the top seven so that the committee could show us they know what they're doing. The way they treat G5 teams. They punish G5 teams for their schedule when if the G5 teams could help that schedule, they would. You got to kind of look at previous, you got to look at the whole whatever you want to call it. All evidence and all evidence suggests that UCF was a very, very good team that got kind of messed around, we'll say, by the committee.
Bill Hancock, by the way, just to throw it out there, executive director of the College Football Playoff, said this, quote, the selection committee respected UCF. After all, they're the group that put the Knights in the Peach Bowl. To qualify for the playoff, this is, again, Bill Hancock speaking. Bill Hancock, not Bill Connolly, the real commissioner. to qualify, he says, to qualify for the playoff, teams need to play tough schedules against good teams. That is the way for all teams to stand out and be ranked high by the committee. UCF is an excellent team, but you still have to take into account who each team played and defeated during the regular season. That's his statement.
Yeah, so just don't rank G5 teams then, because you're never going to put one higher than 12th. You know, that's it. That's what they're saying. They're never, ever going to take G5 teams seriously. And even, you know, and it makes me wonder, like the perfect example was Houston last year when they not only destroyed Florida State in the Peach Bowl in 2015, but then they came into 2016 with a schedule that included Oklahoma and Louisville. The more evidence I see, the more I think they would have probably finished about sixth if they had gone undefeated in 2016. There's just, you can always move the goalposts. Even with a Louisville and Oklahoma on your schedule, you still played in the AAC, therefore you didn't play as many top 25 teams. Why don't you go out and schedule better when they can't? It's not like UCF turned down a bid to the ACC here. They would accept it in a heartbeat, and they would have probably done really, really well in the ACC or the Big 12 or whatever. They were a very good team this year, and it's ridiculous to do the who you played game instead of the how you played game.
Do you think that UCF's victory over Auburn and the argument that people are making right now, including yours, will hasten a move to eight teams so that they can get in?
I mean, if anything does, it'll be that we have another all SEC national title game that ratings sink again. That's what did it last time. I'd love to think that UCF quote unquote proved something, but Houston proved something 2 years ago and it didn't do a thing. So I don't know why things would change now. I hate being kind of like, I feel like I grow increasingly cynical about certain topics in every given year, but I haven't been given any evidence to not be cynical in that regard, and I don't think this will change a thing.
Sometimes cynicism is warranted. I can understand. just looking ahead now, give us your preview. I think Vegas has decided Bama 3.5-point favorite in this All-SEC final. How do you see it?
Yeah, I think my numbers say something like Alabama by 2.5 or 3. It sounds about right. I think Alabama's the safer bet here. But, you know, the bottom line is Georgia has more explosive offense. It's proven that it can work the ball around to more players. Alabama still has basically a one-man receiving core, and they really will not go downfield unless they absolutely have to, and they won't do it very well when they have to. They don't generate a lot of big plays. The offensive line isn't as good as it's been in recent years. And so if the defense isn't amazing and it's only very good, Georgia's going to have a very good chance to win the game. I think I was saying last week, I always pick out Alabama, and I'm almost never wrong to do so. I kind of was starting to lean towards Clemson last week, and I was wrong to do so. So I'm not going to pick against Alabama, but it's easy to see how Georgia gets ahead in this one.
Yeah, I'm going to go with your original statement. You don't pick against Alabama, and I'm not going to pick it to be close. I think Alabama wins this thing by a couple of touchdowns. Georgia is a very, very good team for obvious reasons, as we talked about, but I think their quarterback and I think their style is just tailor-made for Alabama's defense, much more so than Oklahoma's very less than stellar defense was. I think Bama puts the clamps on Georgia, very similar to what they did to Clemson, and wins by a couple of scores. Bill Connolly.
It's definitely in the cards.
No doubt about it. Bill, keep up the great work. We always enjoy it. SBNation.com. Make sure you read Bill Connolly's work there. He is the de facto commissioner of college football. Thanks for coming on with us 2 weeks in a row. Happy New Year again. We'll talk to you soon down the line.
Same to you.
Thank you, Bill. All right, Bill Connolly joining us. It's 4:01. We are just slammed today with great topics, great calls, great interviews, and it will continue into our number two. Coming up in just about 10 minutes or so, Justin Rogers, Lions beat writer, talks to us about why Jim Caldwell got fired and where the Lions go from here. And we'll also talk to him about how a guy like Hugh Jackson isn't fired. By my count, 36-28 is better than 1-31. How come the first guy gets fired, the second guy keeps his job? Justin Rogers joins us right after this, right here on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket.
Mayfield now will throw it across his body back in the end zone. Caught, touchdown. It's Dimitri Flowers, the fullback. And we're an extra point away from another tie game. Hands off to Michelle. Football comes out. It's loose. It's picked up by Oklahoma. Stephen Parker picks it up and runs it back. for the touchdown for the Sooners. Takes the snap, runs to the right, now cuts to the left, into the end zone for the touchdown. They cut out the middleman, Jake Fromm, and Nick Chubb runs it in. And with 55 seconds remaining, we're an extra point away from a tie game to give Oklahoma the lead here in the second overtime. And it's blocked. The field goal is blocked, and we stay tied at 48. And Georgia, the opportunity to kick a field goal and win. Michelle will take the direct snap and run to his left, try to turn the corner. He does, the 20, the 10, the 5, touchdown! And that's how this one will end. And Georgia pours onto the field. The third-ranked Bulldogs will play for the national championship.
But our kids are so resilient. They never stopped chopping wood. They kept fighting. They believed. There was offensive players affecting defensive players in the locker room at halftime, and they kept fighting. Best news is we get a chance to play again.
I quite frankly just missed throws. Didn't make the throws I normally made, and then that showed. Can't believe it's over.
Picks the snap, little slant ball tipped in the air, and it's picked off. Back downfield at the 5. Diving towards the pylon. Touchdown, Mac Wilson. And Alabama pulling away, 23-6.
I think this game was about our identity as a team. I don't think that anybody could question the relentless competitive attitude that we played with. We played the kind of game we wanted to play on offense, scored when we had the opportunities to score. You know, this is something that I'm really, really pleased and happy for our players. They really worked hard.
I don't think there's a lot to say. I remember standing approximately here last year and apologizing to our fans. Poor job we has done as owners, and I would just reiterate that again. Our record's unacceptable, and we accept full responsibility for that. This Hugh Jackson will be back as our coach next year in 2018. He and John are already off to a good start and working well together. You could say a lot of things about us this year, down to the last minute or 2 minutes. Our guys played hard. And I think the primary job an NFL coach has to do is provide leadership, and I think he has provided great leadership.
This morning, I spoke to Coach Caldwell, informed him of the decision not to retain him as the head coach of the Lions. I feel like there was a need in change in the leadership of this team, and starting today, I'll be leading that search to hire a new head coach for the Lions. Coach Caldwell is a good football coach, a good man, good husband, father, grandfather. On behalf of the entire organization, I want to thank him personally and for his service over the last 4 years. Jim has great work ethic. There's not a day that's gone by that his car wasn't in the parking lot before mine. He puts a lot of time and energy into this team, where we are today, part of what Jim did, and I'm proud to say that I work with him. At the end of the day, it's want to take this team to the next level, and to me that's, you know, winning championships. That's winning playoff games, and that's winning the Super Bowl. Ultimately, I'm the person in charge of the football operation here at the Lions, and ultimately, the record that we've had the last 2 years is on me. Really, the standards that I have and the Ford family has for this team are greater than that, and my goal is to go out and find the best head coach to bring us that championship.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed it is. Hour number two underway at 12 minutes past 4 right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, we are Toledo sports leader. Thanks for being with us. Time to shift from college football and the amazing night last night that has led to an all-SEC final back into the NFL, where we found out over the weekend that Jim Caldwell would not be returning for a fifth season as the Lions head coach, despite a 36-28 overall record, a couple of playoff appearances, and really the most successful coach they've had for a while. It was not enough for Bob Quinn. And as striking as it is, a guy who went 1-31 in 2 years in Cleveland does come back for a third season. Joining us now to talk about the Lions is Lions beat writer for the Detroit News, Justin Rogers. Justin, happy new year to you, sir. How are you?
Happy New Year. I think your intro, if it doesn't speak to expectations of our organization, I don't know what does.
You aren't kidding. You are not kidding. And you know what? For that, you know, the fact that that Bob Quinn is optimistic, the fact that he is aspirational, the fact that the organization says, look, it's nice to go 9-7. It was nice to get 1-11 win season. But you know what? We have to win playoff games in order to win championships, and that hasn't happened. We need a new direction. I like that. I don't know if I necessarily like it because I like Jim Caldwell. I think I like him as a person, not that I've met him personally, but I like who he is and how he presents and carries himself. So I don't like that he has lost his job, but I like the fact that the Lions have said we need better than what we have.
Yeah, Jim Caldwell's character, I think, is unimpeachable. He is a consummate leader. I think somebody that you would use as a model for leadership. players respect him and love him to a man, but this is a result-driven business. He got 11 wins in his first season and, you know, has been kind of spinning his tires in the mud with the franchise since then. They've averaged 8 wins over the last 3 years. They snuck into the playoffs with a 9-7 record last year, weren't able to do it. And the one thing, I think the stat that Bob Quinn would point most to in where he was at with this decision was the success against quality opponents. The Lions beat up on the little guys. They did. They went, I believe, 17-2 against opponents that did not make the playoffs in the last 2 seasons. They went 1-12 against opponents that did. And that just kind of showed where they are. They were stuck in the NFL's middle class. The one thing you need in the NFL is a franchise quarterback. The Lions have it. And they've talked, you know, this fan base has talked about wasting Barry Sanders and wasting Calvin Johnson. Matthew Stafford turns 30 this offseason. So now the conversation becomes, are they going to waste Matthew Stafford, the first franchise quarterback they've had in 50, 60 years?
Ironically, Justin Rogers, beat writer for the Detroit News, covering the Lions. Matthew Stafford, the guy you're talking about, lobbied, and you wrote about it yesterday, for the Lions to keep Jim Bob Cooter as his offensive coordinator. Did he go to bat enough for Caldwell, do you think?
You know, it was unusual to hear Stafford make a plea for a coach, and I wouldn't even call it a passionate plea, but a plea nonetheless, because he's just never done that. He didn't do it for Jim Schwartz. He didn't do it for Scott Linehan. He didn't do it for Jim Caldwell. And, you know, I don't think it's largely, or he doesn't feel it's largely his job. And I don't know if I agree with him in this case.
Before you continue that thought, I just want to point to that. I think it is. And in most cities, that is the case. I saw a headline earlier today, and I don't remember where I read it, Justin, but that Bears ownership was considering consulting Mitch Trubisky, rookie, who threw for 2,000 yards and 7 touchdowns in his rookie season, consulting with him before they name a new head coach there. Quarterbacks matter. Yeah. Their opinion matters. If Mitch Trubisky's opinion can be sought out, I mean, I would think Matthew Stafford would be have a very strong say in whoever is hired.
Well, I wouldn't say that his opinion wasn't sought out. I just don't think he made a public plea. But on that same point, I don't trust the leadership of the Bears if that's actually fact, that they sought out the opinion of a rookie quarterback in their head coaching search.
They
shouldn't be relying on a rookie with little experience to make your coaching decisions. That's what you're hired for as a GM, to make those decisions yourself. And I like the fact that Quinn has put this all on him. This is going to be a search with no players involved. He's going to do the research. He's going to consult with his, you know, his peers and his mentors, and he's going to make this decision. It's going to be his, and he's going to stand on that alone.
So if the byline on these articles said Bob Quinn and the little nameplate on the desk said Justin Rogers, would you have fired Jim Caldwell?
You know, under the same circumstances and the same reason that he did, I would have. And there's a, you know, this has been a conversation I've had to have with many readers this week. I don't want Jim Caldwell fired. That was never something that even crossed my mind. You know, I never root for failure of these guys. I'm here to be a neutral observer, but in that role, my objective is to see whether they are meeting the standards set forth and expected for them. Jim Caldwell came in here 4 years ago and said he was going to deliver championships. He didn't deliver a division championship. He didn't deliver a playoff win. And he has the talent on this roster. Some may disagree with me, but I think there's talent on this roster to get it done. And I looked at this season, and I saw Aaron Rodgers out. I saw the Minnesota Vikings down to a third-string quarterback, albeit what we've determined is far better than a third-string quarterback. And the door was open to take advantage of some of those goals, to host the first playoff game in Ford Field's history. And it didn't happen. It didn't get done. They didn't beat the good teams. They actually got worked over by quite a few of the good teams. The final scores were closer than the games in the Atlanta game, in the Carolina game, in the Saints game. They made them close by battling back, but they were dominated in those games. And then you go out against Cincinnati in week 16 with your hopes still alive, and you just lay an egg against a team that got worked over by the Bears 2 weeks prior, 33-7, and got just demolished by the Vikings the week before that. It was a team that looked like it had quit on its season. Obviously, the Lions gave them a little bit of momentum, and they went out and knocked off the Ravens this week, but you can't lay an egg in a meaningful game against the opponent that has nothing to play for. And that was the clear sign that it was time for a change.
I think that's a very good argument. I know Jim Christian wants to ask you a question, but real quick, Justin, this is a question I really wish I didn't have to ask, but I'm going to discuss it at length with the writer who wrote about this for one of your competitors up there in Detroit, another newspaper.
I know where this is going.
You know, you do know. Okay. And Jim Caldwell was asked about it, of course, and he said, no, I do not feel that way at all. But do you believe that his race had any role in the criticism he has taken either from fans or from media who may have suggested that it's time for a change?
You know, I can't speak to the individual fan. I think there's always going to be an element of racism that exists in society, and there are going to be fans that base their decision or as a, at least a factor of it based on the color of skin. And that's, you know, a really sad fact of the world that we live in. But in terms of the media coverage of Jim Caldwell, as somebody that had boots on the ground every single day, I can say with the utmost confidence that he was treated fairly and judged by nothing but what his performance was on the field and in that locker room. I don't know how else to say it. You know, I wish the author of this editorial would have taken the time to step foot in the building, to talk to Jim Caldwell, to talk to the reporters that cover him on the day-to-day basis. You know, there was a great deal of respect between the people that cover him, and, you know, the coach gave it back in most instances. So, you know, it was disheartening to read that, but, you know, it's out there. I think it's been addressed, and I don't know, not much I can do beyond that.
Well, I respect that. That's a very, very well thought out and answered or answer to the question. I'm going to have that particular writer, op-ed writer, on my program tomorrow, and I'm going to ask him. Well, I'll ask him that. I'll say, why didn't you go in and talk to him to get a perspective on this before you came to that conclusion and wrote that? It's very provocative, very controversial, and I think very divisive when it does not need to be. Because I think if he had won that game that he had to win, if he had gone 11-5 or 10-6 and made the playoffs, people are going to be cheering Honolulu Blue, not whether or not the coach who is there is black or white. It is simply a matter of, are we winning or are we not? And if we are we winning enough? Do that and people will cheer a yellow coach as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and so, here's the thing. If you strip away
Martian, just to make sure nobody is taking that the wrong way. But that is the case. Go ahead, Justin.
Yeah, but if you strip away and you put the whole situation in a vacuum and you say coach A is this record and coach B is this record, you know, I understand how you could make an argument based on race, but I really have grown to despise the best coach in line Super Bowl era history, because now you're talking about the healthiest meal on the McDonald's menu. You know, it Jim Caldwell having a slightly above record 500 record is a great accomplishment for a Lions coach. But it's not a great accomplishment relative to NFL coaching. You know, he is an above average coach. I believe that. And he led the team to a slightly above average record. That is a fact. But again, they have a franchise quarterback in place. They have the talent to win. They have not won a division. They have not won a playoff game. And 4 years is a good long try at that. You know, and not everybody gets to be Marvin Lewis and get 15 cracks at it. You know, and not everybody gets to be a Browns coach that gets 1 year and bounced on it, you know, or I guess Hugh Jackson's kind of breaking that trend. But, you know, that's the average lifespan of NFL coaches, 3 to 5 years. It's 4 years. And he didn't get what he said he would get done and what the coach or what the organization expected him to get done. Regardless of the color of the skin, it wasn't enough. And this is why we're here.
Very well reasoned by Justin Rogers, beat writer covering the Lions for the Detroit News. Jim Christian's got one for you, Jimmy.
And this whole escapade and some of the other things, especially when they started trickling out, you know, early last week or whatever, or the week before, it got me thinking, Justin, at what point does some of this go on Bob Quinn and the front office? I realize that Jim Caldwell was here for 4 years, and Bob Quinn and that group came in halfway through. They're just finishing up their second full season. But at what point does some of that have to be shifted to the front office? I mean, this is still a team that doesn't really have a nice running game at all to complement them. They've had other issues at times on the front seven, and there's going to be free agents, of course, to address. Basically, again, when does some of this have to go on Bob Quinn for not filling some of the holes that are still on this team?
Oh, I mean, I think it starts now. You know, I think you give most coaches and general managers, I don't want to say a free pass because expectations are always going to be high in the NFL, but you have some understanding on the first year of the mistakes that they're going to make, especially when they're a first-time coach or general manager. Bob Quinn had a very nice first draft class and, you know, still looks nice in its second year. Second draft class wasn't as immediately impactful. I think you could point to some, as you did, some clear negligence in the running game, the running back position, and the defensive line. There are only so many resources you have to fill holes, but, you know, people are going to keep pointing to that Tease Tabor pick, the second round cornerback who was essentially a healthy scratch for the first half of the season. When they passed on guys like Kareem Hunt, when they passed on a guy like Alvin Kamara, and they clearly haven't been able to run the football through all of Jim Caldwell's duration, and, you know, were the worst team in the NFL this year. So, you know, Quinn certainly doesn't get a free pass, but his real and true judgment will be based on this coaching search. You know, this is the most important decision he's going to make as the leader of this organization. And if he bombs on it, you know, and this coach is the next guy out in 3 years, Bob Quinn's probably going to be broomed out with him.
Justin, let's hit that search real quick before you go, and we always appreciate your time. Terrell Austin is going to interview, or has he already interviewed? Matt Patricia's name is, of course, there. The connection to Bob Quinn from the New England tree or line, if you will, is there. Do you have an early favorite in this, and how many guys do you think will be interviewed by Bob Quinn?
You know, it's really hard not to connect the dots. Just, you know, maybe people consider it being lazy as a reporter, but it's just the natural inclination to connect the dots to past connections. And that makes Mike Vrabel and it makes Patricia the two front runners coming out the gate. And Bob Quinn acknowledged as much that, you know, familiarity is something that probably will benefit a guy out the gate. But I would like to believe, just knowing the snapshots that Bob Quinn has allowed us to see, that he's a smart man, he's a patient man, he's a thorough man, and he's going to go through this interview process as diligently as possible with his eyes wide open and won't be beholden to past relationships when making the decision. He's got six interviews lined up. I think five of them were anticipated. There was a Green Bay linebackers coach, Winston Moss, the kind of a little bit off the radar for most of us, but is in the mix. And I'm not sure they're going to be done at six. You know, I think that maybe a couple more names could pop in there. One I would really like to see is Matt Nagy, the offensive coordinator in Kansas City. I think Andy Reid's coaching tree brings a lot of intrigue with it. He's a guy that had a lot of success at the end of the season when he was given play calling duties for the first time. So, you know, I'm really curious as anybody else to see this play out. I'm going to keep my ears to the ground as much as possible, trying to get the leg up. But, you know, in terms of front runners, you know, I think those guys that Quinn knows do start off in the pole position. And it's their job to, I guess, lose in the interview process.
And Justin, not just front runners in terms of who really is, but what about for Justin Rogers? Who should be the front runners? Do you have a favorite in this thing that you would like to see, or is it too soon for that?
I think it's too soon. Like I said, I really want to see Nagy get an interview. He's young. I only did minimal research, but the Andy Reid coaching tree has produced some really nice names, some successful coaches, and I would like to see that guy get a shot. Shermer has really earned a second shot after his premature run in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. He's done some great work as the offensive coordinator in Minnesota, getting the most out of average players, or not even that, getting the
especially
most out of the talent on his roster.
Especially Keenum. The job he's done with Keenum, I think, is spectacular.
And would anybody have really considered Stephon Diggs and Adam Thielen to be the best wide receiver combo in the NFL a year ago? I mean, those two guys are a lethal tandem. He kept a running game afloat when he lost Adrian Peterson and Dalvin Cook. He's done just great work there. So, you know, I think he's earned that second go around. And Patricia, the background is just so interesting. I mean, he's such a smart guy. He really connects with players. You know, he doesn't have a traditional football background, and the fact that he's a engineering student, and his defenses, as some of the underlying metrics don't portend to great numbers, they've held opponents under 20 points a game for four straight years, and that's the bottom line. You keep opponents off the board, that matters. So,
Justin, you still there? Did we lose him? Okay, I'm not hearing him. Jim?
Well, must be.
Yeah, we just lost it. We were just about to wrap up the interview anyway, and it sounds like cell phone cut out.
Justin,
are you there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. You went silent. You went radio dark or radio silent for about, I don't know, 15 seconds there. So I apologize.
Oh, I must have hit a dead spot in my house.
I'm sorry?
I must have hit a dead spot in my house.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I figured it was something like that. No problem. Hey, last thing before you go, did you watch the games last night, the two college games? Well, there were more than two games, but the semifinal games?
I watched about a quarter and a half in the overtime of the first one. That was when my day wrapped up, and then after 27 hours and 2 days, I passed out before the second one even got going.
The only reason I ask is that everybody's got an opinion on Baker Mayfield. Does he make it at the next level, and if so, how high do you think anybody would reach for him?
He's got a lot of talent, but he's got that Johnny Manziel characteristic in terms of flamboyancy, maybe a little bit of attitude and off-the-field problems. I don't know. I like an edge like that to a player, as long as it's not getting him in trouble off the field. I think he makes it. He's probably going to be a first-round pick. I don't know if I would roll the dice on him if I was the Browns, given the Manziel connection. But
Not at number one. I agree. But I think you're right. I think he very well could be and should be a first-round pick. I would roll the dice with him, too. I do. I like guys with that kind of moxie. And if I was Baker Mayfield, I think I would go find Johnny Manziel and punch him in the face for setting the standard or something that he's always compared to. Because if Johnny Manziel didn't exist, nobody would be saying that about Baker Mayfield, that he could be just like a washout like Manziel. He could just be a very, you know, cocky and very confident guy whose teammates love him. They love that.
Yeah, maybe it's Joe Namath, party boy.
There you go. That could be it. Justin, keep up the great work. I know you got a lot of work to do as far as mining your sources to figure out who the next coach is going to be. We'll keep reading you at the Detroit News and DetroitNews.com, and we'll talk to you again down the line.
Yeah, thanks for having me, as always.
Thank you, Justin. Justin Rogers joining us. Does a tremendous job, obviously, as a beat writer for the Detroit News. All right, that's a lot of stuff to mine through. As I said at the top of the show, if you just joined us, we have so many topics and not nearly enough time. Now we only have a half an hour left to talk about Bama proving it belonged, much to the chagrin of Ohio State fans who thought they should have been the number four team. Bama dismantled number one Clemson. The Rose Bowl, was it the greatest Rose Bowl ever? Debatable, discussable, and we will. Jim Caldwell fired. Hugh Jackson not fired. Jim Harbaugh's Michigan Wolverines ruining the Big Ten's perfect bowl season, and Harbaugh taking fire from all sides. John Gruden potentially to the Raiders. And, oh, by the way, there's going to be a basketball game tonight, and Isaiah Thomas is going to be in uniform playing for the Cleveland Cavaliers. We'll talk about that, too. We're going to try to jam all that into the last half hour of the program, and if you'd like to help direct traffic for us, tell us what you want to talk about from that mess, dial now, 866-240-1065. We'll take your calls right after we check on the bottom of the hour Sports Center coming up.
Right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 1065 The Ticket.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what. Crazy. Crazy football day. Crazy sports day overall, really. But nothing quite as crazy. And I mean that in not the, you know, the proverbial sense. I mean it in the literal sense. Crazy as in insane, mentally impaired, not right in the head. Nothing quite as crazy as the truth behind what I just tweeted moments ago. And Kushlin, tell me if you agree. Nothing says more about a franchise's self-esteem and aspirations than the following. Jim Caldwell went 36-28 with two playoff appearances, and the Lions fired him for not being good enough. Hugh Jackson has gone 1-31, the worst record in franchise or in NFL history. And the Browns retained him. That it? Does anything else need to be said? Does anybody else have any questions whatsoever about how a franchise sees itself, its goals, its aspirations, its hope for the future, its desire for its fans? We're 1-31. Let's stay the course. Maybe we'll win a couple next time around. We're 1-31. Let's keep that momentum going. Lions say, we were just 9-7. Before that, we were 7-9, or 9-7. Before that, we were 7-9. Before that, we were 11-5. Three of those are good. Two playoff years. 1-9-7, not a playoff year, but plus 500. Our fans were at least excited. We had 9 wins. But you know what? We're not about just going over 500. We're not about 36-28 being 8 games over 500. We want to be about winning championships. We've never done it in the history of this franchise, in the Super Bowl era. We've never done it. We've never won a Super Bowl, never been to a Super Bowl, never in the last 25 years won a playoff game. That's got to change. Coach Caldwell took us into the playoffs a couple times, couldn't get us a playoff win. Now we need somebody to take us to the next step. What's that tell you about a franchise's overarching goal, their commitment to their fans, their commitment to what this thing is supposed to be about, not just winning a game or two or having a winning season or two, although I'm sure the Browns would take that right now. But the Lions are saying, we want to be taking steps toward winning championships, not just treading water, not just spinning our wheels in the mud. Hey, we're in a decent place right now, but just spin the wheels where we are, not making any progress, not falling behind. Mm-hmm. Just here we are, 9-7, no playoffs. They want better. And so Jim Caldwell had to go for them to pursue better. And in Cleveland, 1-31. They went 1-15 last year. 1-15. Second worst record in the history of the National Football League. And somehow went backwards this year. Somehow they didn't even spin their wheels. They went backwards and finished 0-16. And said, we're good. We're doing just fine. Hugh Jackson, we'll get him better players. And I've heard that argument so many freaking times. Well, it's not, because I've been posting on Facebook, mostly on my personal page among friends. I've been posting on Facebook for the last 3 or 4 days, really since they finished the season 0-16. Here's one. This was on Sunday while the game was still being played, the game between the Browns and the Steelers. I posted on Facebook, if I'm Hugh Jackson, win or lose today, I resign in shame and embarrassment on general principle. I don't have to wait for Jimmy Haslam to tell me whether I'm being retained or not. I resign because I'm 1-31, or if I win this game, I'm 2-30. It's embarrassing. I clearly have failed. I have a little bit of pride and dignity. I'm stepping away. I'll go back to being a coordinator somewhere. Somebody will hire me to do that. But this is wrong. For me to still be here is wrong. That was my belief on Sunday. It's still my belief today. Then the game ended, and I tweeted or I Facebooked the following. And now for the most important question, what time does the parade start? And I took a lot of hits from people on Facebook, friends and the like. On Facebook, oh my God, you're going to be attending that parade. That is such an embarrassment. Why would you do that? It's already an embarrassing thing for the franchise. Why would you shine such a negative spotlight on the city nationwide? Blah, 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 blah. All that stuff. And my response was, no, I'm not going on. I'm not going to go out to Cleveland and go to the parade. But I love the idea of the parade. Why? Because they earned every inch of it. Jimmy Haslam being in his big office at First Energy Field. Look outside. The parade route just goes right around the stadium. It's gonna circle the stadium a few times. That's the parade route. I want him to look down and be humiliated. I want him to look down and see what his once proud and loyal fans have resorted to send a message that this is unacceptable. This is ridiculous. And the fact that he won't even change coaches despite having the coach who has had the worst coaching run in the history of the sport is another reason for the fans to ridicule, mock, and have that parade. And Kush, what do parades all have? What do you need to have a parade in it, Kush?
Well, let's see. You need
what do you call those great big giant floral things?
The floats and floats. Stuff. Yeah.
I think about 7 or 8 flatbeds pulling dumpsters that are on fire would be the perfect floats to circle First Energy Field.
I hadn't thought about that, but that is perfect.
Would it not be?
Yes.
Flaming dumpsters circling the field for a couple of hours or circling the stadium for a couple of hours. We have the perfect floats for that freaking circus out there to the east in Cleveland. And I still believe that. I then tweeted, Facebooked yesterday, Jim, if you failed at your job 31 out of 32 times you tried to do it, would you remain employed?
I'd probably be gone after number 17.
Right. Well, for most people, if you failed 4 out of 5 times, right. Okay, you're not good at this. If you're a lawyer and you lost 4 of your first 5 cases for your clients, your services are no longer required here. If you are if you're in sales and you miss on 4 of your first 5 client appointments, particularly if they're established clients and it's just resales, you're probably gone. You fail 31 out of 32 times, and you're still employed only if you work for Jimmy freaking Haslam. And then I just Facebooked this about a half an hour ago, Jim, during the top of the hour Sports Center break.
Mm-hmm.
For the sake of perspective, Jim Caldwell was 36-28 and fired by the Lions. Hugh Jackson is 1-31 and retained by the Clowns. That says all you need to know. By the way, if you're scoring at home, just to give you perspective on that 36-28 versus 1-31, that's 35 fewer victories that Jackson has compared to Caldwell, and 3 more defeats.
In half the time, by the way.
Exactly. 35 fewer wins and 3 more losses. One gets fired, the other gets to keep his job. Never in a million years will that make sense to me. Never in a million years will that be okay, and never in a million years should Browns fans have to suffer and endure that. There should be 195,000 people in that parade just to show them, you know what, as happy as we were when the Cavaliers won, and I don't know how many people came out to that parade, what did they say, maybe a million people?
It was like 1.2 or really? Something. Yeah.
Well, then they ought to be able to get at least half that amount, get 550,000 or 600,000 people out there for the Browns 0-16 parade, because as happy as they were during the Cavaliers championship, they are just as miserable, sick, furious, irate, frustrated, angry.
Yep.
Pick your word here at the Cleveland Clown situation. Kush, can you believe that Jimmy Haslam, after that game on Sunday, reiterated to the press, Hugh Jackson will return as head coach?
My favorite part was one of the lines you heard earlier, the Bataz, you know, he's proven that he's a good leader for this team. What games are you watching? I mean, my goodness, how many times have we complained about some basic things, coaching-type things, that were just called wrong during games over the course of this season? And, you know, keeping him for this season, 2017, you know, flashing myself back to a year ago, Bob, I was okay with that. On the grounds of, you know, we don't need any more Rob Chudzinski situations where you give a guy one literal year and then he's out the door.
Yeah.
You know, give him the second year for continuity's sake. But then you one-up yourself in the wrong direction by pulling off the offer. And by the way, you are not only are you welcome, Lions fans, but I'm going to go right out and say the 0-16 2017 Browns worse than the 0-16 2008 Lions, and I don't care what little stat metrics you want to throw my way.
I was just going to say, statistically speaking, the Browns this year averaged more yards per game and gave up fewer yards per game, and I think scored a few more points per game. So statistically, you'd be wrong, but you say they're worse. Why?
I say they're worse. Why? Because there's still, you know, no focus. There's still seemingly no plan whatsoever. And we're relying, Browns fans are anyway, on the next group, this one of Dorsey's coming in to finally, in theory, you know, make the right picks and sign the right guys. And we're all at points where we'll believe that, you know, when they see it. What did the Lions do? They were moving on at that time from the Matt Millen era, which was a travesty in its own right. And they were going to get number one. They knew they were going to take the franchise quarterback. Hello. And we see how, you know, all that has kind of gone since. They're at least a somewhat respectable organization now that they sure weren't in 2006, 7, and 8, that kind of time period. So, and quite frankly, this one is more embarrassing because, you know, you go 1-15. It's like, okay, now you get the number one overall pick and you still have all this money to spend. And they still found ways to completely, you know, screw that up and mess it up. And one more little thing for perspective on this whole season, I from a Browns point of view, I'm actually so happy that the Buffalo Bills made the playoffs. You know why? On top of everything, Bob, now the Cleveland Browns appropriately have the longest playoff drought in the NFL. That had been owned by the Bills, who hadn't gone since 99. Now the Browns are the owners of that other dubious mark that you can, you know, put in the hat with the rest of them or on the jersey or wherever. So I think that's kind of appropriate in its own right, too. And though I wanted to give him, you know, a second year just for continuity's sake, as I said a minute ago, then you go 0-16, and there are times where you just look incompetent doing it. You have to be let go. You just do. And for them, for Haslam and them to say, you know, no, we intend to retain him. He's shown that he's a good leader. It makes me wonder, what is he really watching on some of these Sundays when he's there? Because it doesn't sound like he's watching the same team we're watching.
No, he looks completely clueless, or just, you know, he's a pathological liar, which he may be given his business dealings and the lawsuits his company continues to face.
Maybe a little both then.
Yeah, he may be a pathological liar, and he's got to say something like that. I still think that he cannot reconcile for himself the fact that he picked a completely incompetent man to run his football operation, talking about Sashi Brown. And I mean completely incompetent.
And we thought there were some bad front offices with this team. That one, the most recent one, Sashi Brown, I didn't think anything could trump what we've seen already, and that did.
But then he would also have to admit that he rode with the wrong coach as well.
Yep.
Because all of these were his decisions. Sashi Brown didn't hire Hugh Jackson. Jimmy Haslam did. Jimmy Haslam, everything he has done has been the wrong thing. I saw it worded this way on one of my Facebook posts earlier today, Jim. It appears as though Jimmy Haslam has just decided to undertake the George Costanza School of Business Management. And that is do the exact opposite of what should be done and hope that it all turns out for the best. It is. It's Seinfeldian. It is Costanzan. He is doing the opposite of what everybody else would do. They would fire Hugh Jackson after 1-31. They would not hire a lawyer with zero NFL executive experience. I mean, the idea that this guy even thinks before he acts, I think, is becoming more and more impossible to understand.
And that's really funny that you just made that reference, because what immediately popped into my head is there's a second George Costanza type of line going on here, going back again to what you heard earlier in the hour of the montage, that, you know, he's showed he's a good leader. It's only a lie if you believe it.
It's not a lie if you believe it. Right. It's not a lie if you believe it. Exactly. So, by the way, we didn't get a chance to talk about this much, so let me hit this really quick here before the top of the hour and drive time comes your way with you, yourself, you and Kushner, by the way, in for Mike Miller today. But somebody is going to have to discuss Jim Harbaugh, and somebody is going to have to discuss, this wasn't just a non-progressive year for the Wolverines organization, the program under Harbaugh. It was a massive step backwards year. And I'm not saying they should have stepped forward given all of the talent they lost. 10 starters on D, 7 starters on O to start the season. Starting quarterback Wilson Spate hurt very early. I'm not saying they should have stepped forward, but to fall back as far as they did from last year to this year, It does not look good for a guy who is literally the highest paid coach in all of college football. He makes more money than Nick Saban, who's going into yet another national title game next Monday. He makes more money than Urban Meyer, who beat him yet again and won another Big Ten championship and the Cotton Bowl against USC. None of this looks good. And Jim Harbaugh has to wear a hell of a lot of it. Here's Harbaugh talking about the loss to South Carolina.
They got better as the game went on, no doubt, and made plays to win the football game. And, you know, we didn't get the knockout punch when we needed it. You know, we didn't take advantage of the opportunities that were there. And really starting with the fumble by Sean McCune, which was not Sean McCune's fault. That was our fault. That was a coaching error. We had the wrong personnel in there, and I should have called timeout.
Coach, with the opportunities that have opened up today in the NFL, is there any possibility that this is the last game you coach on this trip?
No.
Coach,
South Carolina.
All right, that's just a little bit of the press conference by Jim Harbaugh after the Wolverines blew a 19-3 second half lead to South Carolina to end the season at 8-5 on a losing run that just quite frankly is unacceptable for the Wolverines. They brought Jim Harbaugh in to make them contenders for the national title. They look further and further from even being in contending status for the Big Ten Eastern Division, half of the Big Ten, let alone for the Big Ten Championship.
Yeah, and we've kind of gone over some of this. And by the way, we'll have our good friend from MazeandBrew.com, Anthony Broom, on to discuss this very topic on tomorrow's show, among other things. And, you know, going forward, it's the fourth year. It's the put-up-or-shut-up year. In theory, he should have a good quarterback this year. Obviously, we had the issues that you just kind of laid out a little bit of for this year. He still recruits, you know, pretty well, but it's put up or shut up time, you know, at this point. It's put up or shut up time. He's got to be do something next year. Got to start beating some of the Ohio States, Michigan States, Penn States, get better than 8 wins. Or maybe if you're Michigan, you start looking at something else.
Yeah, and I don't think that'll be very, very likely, but I will tell you this. The bloom is going to be off the rose, clearly. Honeymoon period is long gone for Jim Harbaugh. He needs to produce this coming season. There is no doubt about that. All right, we are out of time. Really great conversations today with our guests, Justin Rogers and also Bill Conley, talking about college football. So much more to get into tomorrow. We will talk about Michigan more tomorrow and the Harbaugh situation. We will talk about Caldwell. And tomorrow, Jim, just a reminder to everybody.
Yes.
Joseph Hayes. Joseph Hayes is the man who wrote the op-ed on Jim Caldwell last week before the decision to fire him was made, asking, stating that the criticism of Caldwell by media and fans who want him fired is racially motivated, that if Caldwell was not African-American, they would be giving him much, much more slack. I found that to be just a really, really fascinating and, quite frankly, very, very insane point of view. So I said, let's talk, and he agreed. So we're going to talk about that tomorrow at 3:35 and take your calls after. So you're going to want to hear that conversation. All right, that is all the time that we have. Drive Time is coming up next. Mr. Miller is out. Mr. Kushlin is in, so stick around for that. And we'll talk to you tomorrow on the next Extravaganza. See you.
See you at the Right Now Traffic Center right now. We have a two-car injury accident, 475 westbound between Prometica and Douglas. That's causing quite the delay on 75 north and southbound, as that is right near the 475-75 split.